Hi, and welcome back to PDX Food Stories, the podcast for food nerds, restaurant geeks, and farmers market fanatics. I'm your host, Mary Crow, and today on the show, two-time James Beard Award semifinalist and 2012 Food & Wine Best New Chef, Jen Lewis, talks reality TV, her new restaurant concept, Ray, and cookbook, The Book of Greens. Later on the show, the Marshalls and I talk a Portland summer favorite, the Padron pepper, how to use it at home, and how this mild Spanish pepper is popping up on menus across town. So, hi Jen Lewis, welcome to PDX Food Stories. Yeah, I'm really excited to talk to you. When I was researching, there are so many people have published so much about you because you have accomplished so much. It's kind of unbelievable when you look back, with the James Beard nods to the Food & Wine Best New Chef to the TV appearances. It's just like every year was monumental from you from like when you opened Lincoln.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been a good run for sure.
I'm really curious to hear about a Top Chef Masters. When I talked with Gregory about being on Top Chef, he remarked physically just how challenging it was. You're up all day long and you're in these rooms and then you're cooking, and it was almost like an endurance sport for him. Did you find it was the same on Masters?
Yeah, for sure. It's really intense. And you're working with really amazing colleagues that have a ton of experience. It's intense because of, you're not living at home. You are not eating your normal, whatever you eat for your normal diet. Your hours are crazy, early morning, late night, whatever it is. So it is really taxing. I think I always related it to my really busy catering days when I had a catering business. And I worked really, really hard. I would work from early morning, and I'd cater multiple weddings on a weekend. And I'd go to, most of my events, and I'd prep, and I'd meet with clients. And I think that that's one of the things that prepared me for it in retrospect, because it's really intense, and you have to really pay attention to all the details and the people around you and all your equipment. And, it's different every day. So
right.
It was great.
And it's funny when you talk about not eating your normal food, because I remember a conversation you and I had a few years ago where you talked about, like, your diet really is geared to keep you running all day long, right?
Yeah, I have a good, strong metabolism. And I need to work out and all that to take care of myself for sure. But my body works so well with really nutritious food, and I like to eat food that makes me feel really good. So when you have to work and you have a lot of demands on you and you can't really have the normal stuff that makes you feel really strong, you have to kind of, find another way to get that energy for sure.
Right. And so then after Top Chef Masters, you came back to TV as a judge on Hell's Kitchen. What was it like being in the judge's seat as opposed to being a contestant?
It's really cool, actually. It's cool not just as a contestant but also as a chef. And I've been cooking for almost 25 years professionally. And it's really cool to watch young cooks and how they think about food. And mm-hmm. I remember when I was on the show, they didn't tell me how to judge or what to do or anything like that. And it was really interesting to see, a few different people with the same ingredient and how they think to cook it. Mm-hmm. And some were cooked really well, and it was very straightforward how they cooked it. And the one that I chose was actually a really cool cooking method that I've only seen in a couple countries. And it's not all that, far out or anything. But it was just really creative for someone who's a young cook to pull that from their bag of tricks. And I thought that nod goes to them.
Yeah, that's really cool. I wonder, did you have
Were you a little more compassionate, do you think, as a judge having been, or maybe more thoughtful as a judge having had been on that contestant side?
I think maybe, but I also think that, you know, when, you know, I work with young cooks every day in my restaurant, and I know how hard it is to put yourself out there and to learn and to take the guidance that you've been given, and you know, I guess just putting yourself out there is really hard. So I really applaud people who just go for it and find something that they're passionate about, and you know, whether you win or lose. Like I tell people all the time, like, you win some, you lose some.
Right.
It happens to everybody. That's part of the game.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it's cool.
What is the advice that you put out there for young chefs, whether, you know, the coaching and the mentoring that happens in your restaurant or even your time on, you know, these two television programs? What piece of sage advice did you find was coming out of you?
I think the most important things, if you really want to make it happen for yourself, is that you have to work really hard. And granted, that sounds like any industry or any job, but you have to make some sacrifices that if you really want to be good, you have to really focus on learning and learning everything around you and reading everything around you and knowing that you're not going to have Thanksgiving sometimes and going to have New Year's Eve off and, you know, those kinds of things. And it's a lifestyle, not a necessarily a job. It's a job if you just want to do it for a while or if it's not your passion. But if it is your passion, like, you're going to have to understand that it's a lifestyle and you're going to make some commitments to your career that are kind of unique.
Mm-hmm.
I think that you have to roll with the challenges. And I think that, you know, that with so many food TV programs, cookbooks, and so much availability to, you know, access to cooking, I think that there's so many young cooks who don't realize the commitment they need to make, and you got to roll through the hard times because it's not an easy job.
No.
But I'll tell you that the highs are highs, the lows are lows, but the highs definitely outweigh the lows.
So speaking of diving in and learning as much as you can, you have published two cookbooks in 2 years, really deep dives into single subjects. You have Pasta by Hand that came out in March of 2015, and then the Book of Greens, which just came out in April this year. And, you know, like, thinking about timelines, you were probably researching and writing these books 6 months to a year before they actually came out. How much time did you spend researching, and how did you balance that? Because then you were also transitioning your very popular restaurant, Lincoln, into Ray, your new restaurant.
Yeah, well, it takes about 2 years to write a cookbook. My first one took three because I took some time off to do Top Chef Masters. And I wrote my first one by myself. The second one, I had a writer that collaborated with me. And so that was great. But I really love single subjects because I get to learn a lot. And that's one of my biggest joys as a cook is, you know, traveling and reading and learning and researching. And I prefer writing single subject because I get to learn so much about a whole, you know, something under, everything under some kind of umbrella. And
right.
So, yeah, it's a great experience. I love writing books.
And so with Pasta by Hand, you were traveling all throughout Italy, I believe, right? And other countries as well?
Right. No, just
Italy.
And so I did a lot of research from the States and, you know, with email, with internet. Mm-hmm. It's so easy to do a ton of research from home. And then what I did is I basically found a lot of recipes and dishes. Some had never been documented before because a lot of those dumplings, a lot of Italian dumplings are regional,
mm-hmm.
and there's a lot of oral recipes more than written recipes. And so I researched a lot here, talked to a lot of people all over the world, and then I did a really intense fact-checking trip, and which turned into a whole different thing in Italy. where I found all these other recipes I had to include, and all these people wanted to talk to me, and at first they weren't comfortable with me in their kitchen, saw me cook, and they're like, oh, let me show you something else.
That's awesome. How did that compare to Book of Greens? Were you also traveling, or did you write that based off of, you know, your knowledge of what to do with greens?
That was a really incredible book. So Pasta by Hand was more of a book that was documenting a subject of a country.
Mm-hmm.
Book of Greens was documenting I wanted to write a vegetable book, and I decided to do a single subject vegetable book with greens because there's so many great vegetable books out there. And so the Book of Greens was like an encyclopedia, but it became very creative, whereas Pasta by Hand was mostly documenting and creating really solid recipes for people to follow. And Book of Greens let me be really creative and include all sorts of, you know, just standard and really zany recipes that utilize greens. And when I traveled, most of it was done in the States, but I did take two trips within that time that I was writing the book, one to Vietnam and one to Hong Kong. And the markets in those countries blew my mind.
Right.
Because I kind of thought, like, I had all my greens down, and then I was like, oh, my God, there's this and there's this.
Right.
They have six different names. So it was really, really amazing to experience.
I was rereading some articles about Book of Greens last night, and I think you point out that we fall into this rut. You've got kale, you've got spinach, and you've got romaine, and it's hard to break out of that. And I love Book of Greens because if you get a CSA, this book should come with your CSA. I feel like there's nothing in that box that you can't find a recipe for, mustard greens, dandelion greens, strange things that we're not used to. And your recipes are so approachable in this book that I think already if you're faced with an unfamiliar ingredient, the recipe makes you feel accomplished because they're great.
That was the whole goal. Friends and customers were asking me on a regular basis, I got this in my box, what do I do with it? I have all this stuff, what do I do with it? And that's kind of what spurred the topic. And so what you're saying is exactly what my intentions were.
Yeah, it's great. I think it's a great book. I love it.
Thank you.
Yeah, and so speaking of restaurants, as I mentioned earlier, so really you were transitioning, or were you getting ready to transition Lincoln to Ray as you were wrapping up Book of Greens? Because those two happened very quickly within one another.
For sure. I'd been considering it for maybe 8 or 10 months and collecting recipes and organizing a menu. And then probably, 4 months out, I decided to go for it and just kind of got all my pieces together. I worked with a great branding team and my chef de cuisine here, Sarah, she and I, put all the recipes and organized staffing and kind of decided what we need for the shift. And I put together trainings for front and back of the house. And it was pretty smooth. The same guy who made tables for Lincoln, I had him make some additional tables for Ray. And so I just knew the pieces that needed to happen, and we just organized those one at a time and organized when all those changes were going to happen, and really, really smooth transition.
And how that's amazing, because I can imagine if those pieces are not carefully attended to, it could be a rockier transition.
Totally.
And how are customers responding? Do you have people who wander in and they're like, wait a second, I thought this was Lincoln. Where am I?
Absolutely. It's not happening quite as much anymore. I think the word's getting out there. First, there was certainly some of those. But it's really fun. And I think that, chefs get into this thing where you open a restaurant and that's what you're kind of supposed to do for the rest of your life. And I can cook almost anything. And I like to be creative and I like to learn. And I get bored if I'm not, if I don't have a good set of things available to me to research and cook. So it was a really natural time to just play with something new. And there's not a lot of Israeli food beyond you know, hummus and pita and shakshuka in Portland.
Mm-hmm.
Really fun thing to bring to Portland. I've had people come up to me who are like probably in their 60s, and this woman said, I've never eaten anything that tasted like this, and I absolutely loved it. And I thought that was cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was great.
Is there anything from the Lincoln menu that customers like cannot let go of?
You know, we have a little pasta on our happy hour menu that people love. And I actually had an old Lincoln regular email me and ask me to do a Lincoln dinner for his girlfriend for her birthday as a surprise. And so we created a menu from Lincoln and sat them in the back booth and a Lincoln dinner. And that was pretty sweet.
That's really awesome.
Right.
And so what on the new menu, what are customers loving? And then what are those secret kind of menu items that you really want people to try, maybe they just haven't broken out of a comfort zone yet?
Sure. You know, one of my favorite things about the menu is that it's all very shareable food, but if you want your own entree or whatever, you can certainly order that. But it's a place to share. And I think it's lovely how just by the nature of the cuisine of Israeli food, which you know, that's a huge, there's so many cultures that live in Israel, so it's pretty vast as far as the kinds of food there. But as far as what's just by the nature of the cuisine, there's gluten-free, there's dairy-free, mm-hmm. there's vegetarian, there's meat options. So enjoying a dinner with a group is so easy, and no one feels singled out because they don't eat whatever. And it's very simple to accommodate, and it's. I think that's one of my favorite things about the menu. As far as the dishes, they're just fun and they're flavorful and they're kind of heightened varieties of what you see in some of the traditional kitchens in Israel. I love our the Yemenite stew. It's a traditionally a Sabbath stew that has chicken and hawayad, which is a Yemenite like a curry blend, a blend of spices, and then. You know, our malabi, which is almost like panna cotta, but it's made with milk rather than cream, so it's lighter because the weather's so warm in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
So it's nice to have all those flavors and all those textures that are familiar but not quite.
Right. And then the bar program, too. How has the bar program changed from what you're doing at Lincoln to complement the dishes at Ray?
The bar program is really fun. I wanted to create something that's a little bit different than one what we did at Lincoln, but also something that's a little bit different than what people have had. And so I love creating cocktails, and I wrote the cocktail list, and they're really fun flavors. There's pomegranate, there's date, there's a drink called that's like basically a white Russian. And it includes tahini and a little honey in it. And I call it the Ashkenazi. The Ashkenazi is a Jew typically from Eastern Europe. So the Russian would be an Ashkenazi. So we call it an Ashkenazi. And so everything kind of has something funny or something lighthearted to it. And then the wines are cool. We've got a bunch of Israeli wines that are spectacular. We've got a Lebanese wine, Lebanese beer, and then, you know, some favorites around the world, too.
That's really awesome. So should we expect an Israeli cookbook next from you?
I have a cookbook in the works, not Israeli, but I'm shopping it right now, so it'll probably be released as far as the topic fairly soon. And it is single subject.
Get out.
Predictable.
So let's talk about your garden. I follow you on Instagram, and I am always anxious to see what you are growing because I'm a new gardener. I didn't really start until we bought our house, and this is my third season now, and I'm getting better every time, but I love to see what other people are growing. So what are you growing in your backyard?
Well, one of the things like with Book of Greens is that I think there's greens you buy in the grocery store, greens you buy in the farmer's market, and then greens you grow. So I try to grow things in my garden that I typically wouldn't get at the grocery store or at the farmer's market. So I want to have something unique in my garden. So I've got a cool Lebanese squash that I'm growing.
Oh, wow.
You know, I have some staples like kale and that type of thing. I have these cool Chinese long beans that are purple that when they grow, they're just beautiful long purple beans that grow up a cage. Got some cool tomatoes. I have a strawberry, an orange strawberry tomato. I've got a green tomato, and I forget what it's called. I've got a few cool cucumbers, and then I grow a ton of herbs that are, like, I've got Vietnamese coriander and lemon balm and
awesome.
A good variety.
And where are you getting your, are you getting starts or seeds, and where are you getting them from?
Do a little combination. I like to plant seeds, but just due to the time that I have, sometimes I need the quicker jump start. And I love Garden Fever. I think they've got a great variety.
Yeah, I love them.
Seeds, yeah.
They're great. Cool. So before I let you go, I'm curious, when you actually have time off and you're not in your garden or you're not researching around the world or on TV, where do you like to go in Portland? What are you excited about right now that's happening in our city?
Oh, you know, I just due to my nature of how much I work, when I'm not working, I spend a lot of time at home. I love cooking at home, and I think that a home-cooked meal is one of the most spectacular things, whether it be what you cook or a friend cooks for you. I spend a lot of time with my neighbors and friends, so that's most of the time. But I am a sucker for really good soup. I grew up in Southern California, and so Mexican food is you know near and dear to my heart as well. But I think that Asian soups around here are pretty spectacular, and I can usually just go up and down 82nd and find you know almost anything. I really like Ken's Noodle House up on near 82nd, and I think their soups are really traditional and just really soulful. Delicious soups.
Mm, yes, that's the one sad thing about living in North Portland is 82nd is so much further away now.
True, true. I know, for sure.
Okay, so this segment, still unnamed. Wait, what's fresh and what to do with it and what other people are doing with it?
Is that the segment name?
That's the segment name. Until we come up with something different. Maybe one of the listeners can suggest a better segment name than that.
What's fresh? I mean, it's good, but it's a little long.
Yeah, so the idea being we cruise around the farmer's market, we find what's fresh and hot, and we get some ideas for what to do with it once you've exhausted eating it just straight up, and then what other people are doing with it. So this week we're talking about padrón peppers. And padrón peppers are an inch and a half, 2 inch long. They're kind of chubby, a little bit twisted, and for the most part, and they're green, and for the most part, they're super mild, except like every one or two, you get a scorcher. And most people just eat these fried, like sauteed in olive oil or canola oil, tossed with a little bit of salt. And now, like at the farmer's market, everyone sells them. Like every farmer has padrons. But like 6 years ago, really, there was just one farmer who had these peppers. And that is Manuel and Leslie Rico of Viridian Farms, now Conserva.
They were the first people that we saw carry them at the market. But yeah, you're right. Now a lot of people have them. Because
right.
I think that once people knew what they were, the demand for them went up. So at first, when Viridian came with them to the market, well, it's like this when they came with anything to the market, people
right.
would line up
yeah.
to get it. You know,
right.
So it was like that when they first brought padrons. When they first brought their strawberries, their asparagus.
Right.
But then I think once they taught people what to do with them, including chefs, everybody wanted them.
Right.
Wanted to eat them, wanted to cook with them, wanted to grow them.
Well, a pint will run anywhere, like a little pint container will run anywhere from $4 to $6.
Yeah.
So I can imagine this is a pretty profitable crop to be bringing to market.
Well, because the plants are pretty prolific, too. So yes. They, you know, you can have one plant and it has a lot of peppers. But the problem is that the season isn't very long.
Right.
So that's why people buy them up.
I feel like now in Oregon there's two seasons for it. There's like now and then in like late August.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the chefs I was talking to, they're like, we're not doing anything right now. The price is really high.
Right.
It's that first wave. And then the
right.
second wave comes. And the farmers just are like, we've got to sell
yeah.
this crop.
So,
which is what we do too. I mean, when we first see peppers and tomatoes at market, that's not when we're buying them. We wait until later on, once
right.
all the direct market customers have their fill, and then we can.
Right. So to, I guess, mitigate my spending on them, my
yeah.
weekly spending, I started growing some, and last night I picked my first. I just have one, like one. I brought it in like a champion. I'm like, we have one pepper.
And did you cook it? Or did
no,
you
not yet. Right, right now, it's sitting out as a shrine to more peppers
mm-hmm.
to be grown.
We did that with our first tomato too.
Yeah, but okay. So we eat them. Like I can't get enough of them just simply sautéed with salt. I mean, this is the perfect to me, like afternoon snack, or even like I've taken my cast iron skillet and I have like no oil and just let them blister
That's
in the cast iron. Toss with some flaky sea salt, and then whatever your beverage of choice, whether that's water, kombucha, or wine, like there's no better mid-afternoon weekend snack to me. But what else can you do with these?
Well, I think they're a really nice pepper. I'll just say where I think they fit in the pepper scale is that they're not very spicy. And even when you do get a spicy one, I mean, to me, just because we work with so many spicy peppers, I don't think they're very spicy. But I think they're very approachable, and they... What I like to say is that they can take the place of like a bell pepper.
Mm-hmm.
A bell pepper.
Oh yeah.
You know, we can get those all the time, and they're not really that great. Like people will use them, but you could use the padrones in place of recipes where you see them call for bell peppers, and they have much more flavor.
Right.
The thing to be cautious of is that the cell walls are a little bit thinner,
mm-hmm.
so they don't really freeze. Like a lot of peppers, we can freeze a lot of our peppers, but the padrones don't really freeze very well. So what I like to do with them is, of course, pickle them. I think they're nice, like quick pickled, like
oh, okay.
you would do maybe some kind of, what are those peppers called that are like the Italian peppers, not the ones packed in oil, but...
Oh, the pepperoncini.
Pepperoncini.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I've never thought to
so
that. Yeah.
That's how I like to do them. So
right.
they get, because they do have thinner cell walls, they get
sure.
softer. So they're really nice to just do whole and put on a sandwich.
Oh, yeah. That's a great idea. So
that's
would you
nice.
Ever do a ferment on them? Or they're too, they're just too delicate?
They might
break
get
down.
A little bit too slimy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're so mild that I don't
yeah.
really know what.
Right.
What it would bring.
But yeah, I can just taste that like garlicky, pickly.
Yeah. It's really nice, and then you still get, because they do have their own particular sort of mild flavor that's not bitter like some of the milder peppers can be. The other thing that you can do with them is that, you know, like a smoked, like a chipotle pepper is a smoked jalapeno, so you could approach it in that way. Where
awesome.
You would smoke it,
right.
and then you could dry it.
Is that something like you would, on a grill, like smoking on a grill with some wood chips?
Yeah, or like in a smoker, like if you have like a little chief smoker or
Got
something
it.
Like that, something you would smoke meat in. You can do peppers too.
Cool.
And then you could powder them, or you could use them later in the year for rehydrating.
Powder them. So, okay, so after you smoke them,
yeah.
then you would throw them in a, like a coffee grinder, like a smaller grinder, or could
yeah.
you do it in a Vitamix?
You could do it in, I would use a Vitamix, because that's
right.
what we use, and it kind of pushes air up through, so you get
Got
a finer
it.
Powder. So you would do it one time, and then I would dry it again, like just in the oven a little bit, because your pieces are going to be a little bigger, and then do it
one more time right.
to get the really nice powder.
And then you could mix that powder with salt if you wanted to do like a chili salt.
Yeah,
for...
or you could make like some kind of rub or
right.
something like that.
That's
you
a great idea.
Salt and then use that on your blistered padrones that
yeah.
you did.
Whoa.
Double padrone. I like it.
Mm-hmm.
I think you just, you have a food cart.
There it is.
There it is.
I'm also doing margaritas.
Oh, that's
so.
True. Yeah.
Watch out, Jacobson.
Well, you would only use Jacobson salt, obviously.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, I'll speak to them and see.
Yeah.
See what we can come
see
up with.
See if we can work something out.
So how are you, so you said chefs aren't quite using them yet, but I'm sure
Some
they're starting
are.
To like
there's,
generate ideas.
There's the first wave for sure. So the first person I spoke to was David Sapp. He's the chef in Park Kitchen. And they have two Padron dishes right now. One of them is a grilled albacore with a gochugaru, which is like a Korean red chili aioli, with the fried fingerlings, the padrons, which are fried, ice plant, which I had to look up.
What is that?
Edible succulent.
Interesting.
Yeah, and pickled blueberries.
Wow.
So he said it's like a Korean niswa salad. I never quite know how to say that.
Niswa.
Is that it?
I don't. Maybe someone
sounded
will correct
really
us.
Good.
Thank you.
Okay. Perfect. Niswa.
Niswa.
And then the other dish they do is a salad. It's beets, padrons, purslane, almonds, and smoked chèvre.
And the padrons are whole again. Probably just.
He didn't specify size on those padrons, but.
I feel like Park Kitchen is always one of those restaurants where I'm like, I need to get back there.
Yeah.
I forget. Like, I've had excellent meals there, and
I
need to get
to
back
go
there.
This week.
Awesome.
I'm pretty excited.
Ooh, yeah. Which, are you going to have one of these two dishes?
I think we have to.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think
sure.
you do.
And then I will say that so many people were just simply blistering them and then lemon and salt. And I think that that's one of those iconic things that
right. It's
become the dish and
yep. Everyone
loves it. So why mess with it?
Right.
So the few that I chose are people that were doing something either a slight different take on that or something totally different. Aaron Barnett at Le Moule, he's charring it, and I think it's chopped with like corn, green coriander, and a pimenton aioli.
Mm.
That just hit the menu yesterday.
Oh,
so
cool.
That is super current. And then Joel Stocks and William Preach. Sorry, but if I'm saying your last name wrong, and like a question. Should be a question. Preach? So I should ask you. Anyway, at Hold Fast, they're doing a charred and seared, served with squid, romesco, and cherry tomatoes. But in the past, they've done it as an ice cream base.
Whoa!
Yeah, which is a reaction I think anyone has when they go to Hold Fast. There's always at least one dish where you're just like...
Well, I hope they make it again.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
I'm going to ask to please have a heads up there for that.
And then do you have an artisan to feature this week?
No artisans, but I have something equally special, and that is sort of on the pop-up realm. While Holdfast was before, I think previously a year ago, referred to as a pop-up, they're pretty regular in their
mm-hmm.
dining now. But Kusuma Rao of Rushikala, she's doing, she gave me a couple ideas, so here we go. She's one of my favorite people, so she gets
I think everyone here at the table looks
here. If you haven't been,
we're the Kumi fan club.
Go to Rushikala. Yeah, I should. So number one, blistered with a spicy garlicky fenugreek yogurt. And like, it was the first time we ever had padrons. Sidebar was at Momofuku in New York, and it was seared with lemon and togarashi, and I feel like that's what I've chased with every padron ever since.
Wow.
That I want that spice that they put on the
right. Outside
of that pepper, because it's such a mild pepper. So when she says something spicy, when Kumi says something spicy, I'm like, I know it's going to be spicy.
Yeah, like
right. Makes
your mouth water.
It's,
yeah.
I'm like salivating. Gross. Okay. She also just serves them simple, just straight up, but on the side of a mustard that she's made out of her lemon pickle.
God, that's my favorite.
Which has ghost chili in it,
Whoa.
Which is amazing. So again, she's incorporating all this spice and
heat,
I think, to... Well, that's just rude.
We just had
fly on the mic.
Microphone.
This will be an edited fly on the mic edit.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, hey-o.
So she takes that mellow, wonderful padron, but then beefs it up with this spicy, just pungent mustard, which I think sounds amazing. And then lastly, you know, chard, which we've all had, but then she stuffs it with paneer.
Wow.
Farmer's cheese.
Oh my gosh. Wait, so she makes like a charred roll?
Yeah, I guess.
And then stuffs it with the cheese and the pepper?
Yeah.
Wow.
So I think it's the charred pepper then stuffed with
the
cheese.
Charred. This happened
gross.
The last time we talked about something charred. Remember you made this soup and you're like,
oh,
it's a charred tomato
charred.
Soup. And I was like, oh
yeah,
great, where's the Swiss charred? And I thought literally you were talking about a Swiss
charred
roll-up.
Charred.
Like the pepper has
like,
been blackened
there
with charred.
Is, yes.
Yeah.
Got it. So, okay, that makes a lot more sense. Wow, that
sounds awesome.
That does sound awesome. So when is her pop-up?
So for all of her pop-ups, she does them in Portland as well as in Tucson. You can go to Ruchikala, Ruchikala, period, WordPress. And that's where you'll find all the information for all of her dinners.
Very cool. Yeah, I feel like Padron's, you know, it's the classic tapa, which is the charred with, not Swiss chard, blackened with salt and maybe some lemon. But I feel like that, you know, the popularity, especially of them in Portland, has probably, I don't know, encouraged people purchasing shishito peppers in the market and also at restaurants. I don't think I ever would have ordered a shishito pepper appetizer before, but now I see it on the menu and I think, okay, this is basically the Japanese version of this very mild, sometimes a little bit spicy, but not crazy, pepper that has been blistered and then usually sprinkled with a little togoroshi. And I love it because then I get my fix year-round.
Yeah, I think there's something really beautiful about having seasonal produce where it's like, look, all we did was apply some fire and a little bit of seasoning, and there it is in its beauty. But
right.
I also really love to see people say, look, it can lend itself this way or mm-hmm. be elevated in another way. It's really fun to see what the chefs are doing.
I think if my plant produces more than one, I am definitely going to try pickling them because I love pepperoncini. Like, my mouth, I am literally fighting back saliva because anytime I think about it, everything goes into gear. But I'm always a little bit suspicious, like, why is it fluorescent yellow? And, like, I would love to kind of make my own and have, like, a more, I don't know, homemade version.
I don't know why it's fluorescent yellow.
Right?
It's not how it should look.
Right. I wonder if it's, like, mustard powder.
It could be, but even then, sometimes mustard powder is made with dyes.
Right,
so
right.
So I would say if it is, it's probably a dyed mustard powder.
Right.
Because regular mustard powder, if it was in there, would be a little darker.
Right, yeah.
Would it just be some of them are, like, younger? Like, they haven't fully matured?
Maybe if they're, like, a banana pepper yellow.
Could be.
Yeah.
Peppers.
Awesome. Well, we will be sure to link to all of the chefs and the restaurants that you mentioned, along with Kumi's website, so people can check that out. Thank you both. And next time, we'll be back with another What's Fresh? What to do with it? What other people are doing with it?
Yay!
All right, that's it. That's our show. Thank you for listening. Please send any feedback you have, any comments, any ideas you have for food stories you'd like to hear or ingredients you'd like to know what to do with them and what other people are doing with them to pdxfoodstories@gmail.com. All the links to Jen's restaurant, her cookbooks, TV appearances, etc. will be up at the website, pdxfoodstories.com, as well as links to the restaurants mentioned in the Padron segment. I'll be back in a few weeks with a really special guest. I'm super excited to interview Sarah Massoni from the Food Innovation Center here in Portland. And we're going to take a deep dive into the Can't Get Enough total peak of the season, cherry tomatoes. I know it sounds like an ingredient you probably know what to do with it, but I think you'll be pretty surprised to hear how chefs are using it on their menus around town. Until then, have a great couple weeks.